Hey everyone, welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Nina Pantic, joined by Irina Falcone. Irina, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right, so this episode, we are going to have Ken Skupski on. He is a top doubles player. He's a little bit older. He's 37. He tells us all about his experiences playing doubles, being a doubles specialist. He also went to LSU. But before I introduce him, let's talk about what's going on in WTA world right now, because kind of nothing. Last week, we had Ostrava, and after that, there's one tournament in Linz, and that's it. So, Irina, what have you been hearing?
To be honest, not a whole lot. There's been a lot of players that have decided to just end their season, go on vacation. I was talking to one player that's in the Maldives, which, as we've spoken before in this podcast, is like the number one destination for tennis players. I was talking to Madison Keys and I asked her, I was like, oh, when you're traveling again? And she told me it was December 14th that she would be traveling again. And that is because for Australian Open this year and to enter Australia, you're going to have to do a 2-week quarantine. And it's very interesting for some players because, I mean, it's like you come back pretty much. Some players just played two tournaments on the comeback from the pandemic. And so you really aren't getting that much momentum and you don't want to start your preseason too early. And so there's just a lot of what ifs right now. That's what I'm hearing a lot of. There are some challengers in the States. I believe Macon is happening. And there's maybe another tournament in Texas, but there's not a whole lot to do. So it'll be interesting to see what players do as a preseason or where they go to vacation next.
It's hard because you also can't really vacation freely. You're not really supposed to be traveling for fun. So as a player, you might not want to share as much. We have seen some footage of players and footage as in like Instagram posts of them going home, which used to be a bad thing, sitting at home for 6 months, but players have been gone for almost 2 months at this point. So it makes sense. I also noticed that Daria Gavrilova, one of our former podcast guests, just survived that 2-week quarantine in Australia, spent the full 2 weeks in the hotel and could only open the door to get food that was being delivered to her door by a security officer. And she and another player, Ellen Perez, had adjoining rooms, so at least she didn't completely lose her mind. But 2 weeks in a hotel is not an appealing way to get ready for a Grand Slam. So I've heard Craig Tiley, he's a guy, obviously the big man in charge of the Australian Open. He has said that they're trying to figure out a way that Melbourne and Victoria, the state, obviously allows players to go to a tennis court and at least the gym, or else they're not going to come. It wouldn't make any sense, right? Can you imagine, Irina, your preparation being 2 weeks in a hotel room?
I can't imagine that. And you're leading up for pretty much the start of your season, the first slam of the year, and actually you're not going to practice for 2 weeks. It's not easy. So I'm sure that they're going to be able to come up with something to have a safe environment for players to practice, to use the gym. But honestly, I mean, this is just the year where you just have to roll with the punches. And if you don't get 2 weeks of training in the gym and the tennis court, you'll be there with everyone else on the same boat, you know?
I don't think so. I'm different than you. I don't think this is going to happen because I don't think it's going to be fair. Australian players like Daria are already there. They're going to be there for months in their own home. Her, especially, she's from Melbourne, and they're going to have a different advantage. I don't see this tournament happening if the 2-week thing is at all in existence. And things have been changing pretty quickly, especially in the US in terms of like protocols. But Australia has been pretty firm on this. Like, they are very serious. I respect it completely, but I don't see this tournament happening. A lot of tournaments have already been canceled. Like, you know, the tournament that we know, the one in Midland. Wow, how did I forget that? They just announced they're moving from February to November. And February, I mean, a few months ago, February seemed like it was going to be in the clear. And now I'm like, no, February is also in a very bad spot.
This November, like next month?
No, like moving to like 2021 November.
Oh, okay.
With plans to play it in February of 2022, which I love that. Let's just go back to back.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, the indoor court, like the indoor hard court players are going to love that.
It makes
sense.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting. It'll be very interesting. You bring up a good point. And my biggest thing is, though, if you're going to Australia for 2 weeks, let's say you have to do that, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of players just decide to skip that slam as well.
Exactly.
I mean, why even go if you know that you're not going to be prepared, you're not going to be ready? Kind of just have to toss it to the side. That's kind of been the theme.
And financially, I'm trying to think of players that are outside of the top, let's say 50, let's be generous, top 50. You have to go and fund yourself for like 4 months in Australia, or, you know, 2 months in Australia. That's double than what you're used to, which already costs so much to go there. And I know that I'm not sure if this applies to tennis players going for the Australian Open, but all of my friends that are trying to go home to Australia have to pay the, you know, the $3,000 flight plus $3,000 for the hotel. That's $6,000 just to show up. Some players can't really swing that, especially after 6 months off.
So I did not know that you actually had to pay for your hotel, because I know US Open was wonderful in being able to provide hotel for players during the US Open. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of players just decide to just kick that one to the curb.
I don't know if, yeah, they're going to pay for it, but I'm not sure yet. But I know for normal people, for the regular humans, they've been paying, and it's not great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you also have to take into the account, like, one of the things that they've been doing in the past couple of years, if they've been making Australian Open, like the swing, a little later in the year, so you're able to spend Christmas and New Year's with the family. How many players do you think are actually going to be like, all right, I'm just going to spend my Christmas and my New Year, like, not that New Year's is a big thing, but Christmas is pretty important. And especially to spend it in a hotel room, that's tough.
Especially this year, I think people are a little bit more attached to being with their families during such a, I mean, a global crisis is not an easy thing to be like, buy families to you guys in 2 months for something that might still not even happen. It's crazy. But I haven't noticed that many players retiring as a result of this. I don't know. Maybe they're waiting to see how things play out. I'm not saying that our guest, Ken, is planning on retiring, but he is 37. He has three kids, three little boys. He'll explain in the episode. And you kind of see him thinking about what he's going to do next. He also talks a lot about his younger brother, Neil, who has teamed up with Jamie Murray, pretty much abandoning his brother in the final stretch of his career. But they're both cool with it. And you'll hear him talk about his brother, which I think is really nice, because you see he kind of like led him onto the tour, led him to college, to LSU, kind of boosted him and helped him in his career. And that, I don't know. I know the Bryan brothers, everyone talks about a lot. They did retire, but to see brothers on tour is fun. To hear him talk about his brother is really, really sweet. And he also talks about how he's thinking about what's next, which makes sense at that age.
So, honestly, yeah. With tennis, the way sports are, you have to constantly be thinking about that. Not that you have to constantly be thinking about retiring, but you just never know. With an injury, with anything that can come up, global pandemic, you just have to have your doors open, and you have to make sure that you have opportunities there that you can kind of jump at.
On that note, let's jump into my interview with Ken Skupski. I talked with him at World Team Tennis. So yes, it was a while ago, but we talk about things that are not about World Team Tennis. So hold on, everybody. And he talks about his brother Neil a lot. So get ready for that. Here's Ken. All right, Ken Skupski, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How did you guys get into tennis? Was it you first and then he followed you? Because you're about 6 years maybe older than?
Yeah, I'm an old man now. Now, where our house is in Liverpool, my parents sort of run one of the tennis clubs there and open our back garden. Just beyond that is the tennis club. So it was an easy thing for us to sort of learn to ride our bike on the tennis court, you know, socialize at the tennis club. And my dad loves tennis, and we just went out there at a young age. I mean, I think I started 3 or 4 years old and had a decent talent and worked hard. And it came about, you know, doing well in junior tennis that Neil obviously started to play as well. And he went down a slightly different route to me in the sense that my dad thought I played too much. So Neil didn't go all over the country playing tournaments all the time. I would probably say I'd play 25 tournaments a year and he'd play 5. But fortunately, he was a talented player, young, up-and-coming kid with, you know, lots of talent, but never really sort of did anything on the junior scale. But I went to LSU, so I told the coach that I think you've got a good player here. Nobody else is recruiting him because nobody knows him, but take a chance on him. And they did, and, you know, he became All-American, and I think he got to number 2 in the nation. So he was a bit of a, you know, bit of a dark horse in college tennis.
I mean, good thing he had you around to vouch for him.
Yeah, he's done well having me around. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say, I mean, I've taken chances on him because I know how good he can be and how good he has become. I don't know whether that's just being biased, but I did see a lot of talent and capability in how he could play at a young age, leading into sort of the professional game. And I think it was a massive gamble for myself to take him on. I think he was ranked like 600 or 700 in doubles, and I was top 100. I just split from one of my partners, and I was sort of at a bit of a loose end on what to do because I wasn't playing ATPs. It was more of a challenger level. And I thought the sooner I could get Neil his ranking up, the more chance we'd get to play together. As you're saying, I'm 6 years older. So this was, you know, back in 2013. And the quicker we could get him up there, the more chance we'd have of playing a longer time together. And fortunately, we managed to sort of hit the ground running. We knew each other, obviously, fairly well. Even though people think as brothers, we know each other inside and out. But I went to college, then he went to college. So we were apart for a good 10 years. But we knew enough about each other and how we needed to do. So I mentored him and we got him into the top 100 within a year. So it was a gamble that paid off. And then he just went ahead and, you know, went ahead of me and threw me by the wayside. No, I'm only joking. He didn't really.
He kind of did.
Yeah, kind of did. No, he knew I was in a position where I was all, you know, getting older and things were getting a little bit more difficult with family. So it was a family decision when obviously Jamie came in the options to play doubles with him, and it was a worry for me at first, but it ended up being okay. I mean, I've done okay since. But it's never the same without playing with your brother.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the tennis.com podcast with special guest Ken Skupski. He's telling us all about playing tennis on tour with his brother, Neil. Keep listening.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Neil got picked up by Jamie Murray, and that's an offer you don't really refuse, but I think you're doing okay. When did you guys realize you were going to try and chase pro? Like, were you personally always going to go to college, or did you consider going pro when you were younger, when you were a teenager?
I think my parents always were pretty good about the academic side, obviously making sure you got, you know, got some stability in life. In the way the LTA was working, I was still in school, and a lot of players were turning pro at 16 and going to like academies and stuff run by the LTA. And I just didn't feel I was good enough to do it at that such a young age. And I'm a family man. I don't particularly enjoy being away from home for long periods of time. So I did everything based at home, and I felt like we made good decisions on coaching and stuff like that. You always have the idea that you want to turn professional, but you don't really know until, you know, you've got some elite tennis players that at a young age, they know that's where they're going to go. I was, you know, fourth or fifth best player in the country. I think I just had an idea that college tennis was the best place for me. I'd spoken to enough people who turned professional young and then retired at 22 because they were burnt out, losing lots of tennis matches. And I just didn't feel like I was ready for that. And I love the team environment. So going to college was another, you know, great idea to sort of be in that team scenario. And I felt I flourished in college. I did great at LSU, and the idea of playing 80 matches a year was great. And, you know, having success in college gave me the belief that I could go on and do something in the professional game. You know, looking back at previous players, at what their rankings were and where they were going. That was the idea. And I think sort of halfway through college, I knew I'd got a decent chance of turning pro. How far you could go, you just don't know. You just got to get out there.
Were you considering going pro in singles as well? Is that something that you were trying to do? Or was doubles a natural?
Doubles was definitely more natural, just from the sense that as a, you know, as a kid growing up, club tennis was always doubles at home. I was also the fat boy when I was young. It was a tough thing for me moving around a tennis court. I've never been, you know, the fittest guy in the world, and that sort of showed on the court the way I moved, and I also think I moved poorly in the sense technically poorly, which didn't help until sort of mid-20s when I started to dine. I mean, the way tennis was played when I was younger was everything was off the front foot. Nowadays, everybody's, you know, hitting big shots out wide, and I was never sort of taught how to do that properly. And it showed on the tennis court the way I played, because I was very aggressive. But whenever I was under pressure, I could never sort of, you know, transfer my weight through the ball, and it just never worked for me. I had a good college career. Don't get me wrong. I beat some good players. But I knew I turned pro probably to try both, but I knew doubles was the way forward. I think after maybe 12 months, I got to like 500 singles and 140 in dubs. So I sort of had an idea where this was going.
How did you pick a partner though? When you first finished LSU and you're thinking to yourself, I want to go play some futures, how do you even begin to choose a partner? Because sometimes doubles, at least from what I've seen, is considered the second. Everyone goes for singles and doubles is just there available. How do you turn pro in doubles?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you generally play singles to start with, always, because the futures level, if you're a good player, you've got a chance of doing okay at futures level. It's once you get to the sort of the challenger level where things start to get real tough. That's the feeling that I felt. So I had a good college career. I felt like I was winning matches at futures level. Things were going okay. But my singles and my doubles ranking were going further and further apart. And at that point, it was more apparent that it was time to sort of focus on doubles. And that's when you start to sort of recognize the rankings where you're at and who you're sort of potentially able to play with. Very rarely do you get a guy top 100 playing with a guy 300. You're always sort of round about the same, just because it means you get into the same tournaments. And at the time, my first, you know, full-time doubles partner was Colin Fleming, who was a great player. And we hit the ground running when we started playing. I think we won our first 16 matches together. So it was four tournaments in the row to end, I think it was 2008, I would say. And then we had a fairly successful 2009. We beat the Bryans, first tour event match, or first tour event. Won two tour events, and broke inside, I think we were broke inside the top 50 sort of within the first 12 months together. So that was pretty lucky to sort of have someone who was sort of, you know, very similar dedication to doubles as I was. Unfortunately, it didn't work out over the course of the next two or three years, and we went our separate ways. But finding a partner, you know, once you're up there and you're established, you will get offers, and you're sort of trying to find someone who sort of has similar skill set to you, or someone you sort of get along with off the court. You know, if even though you can play great on the court, if you don't get along with them, it's not easy. So you see that quite a lot, that guys sort of go their own ways because they don't socialize together, and they find things more difficult on a personal level. But some people are, you know, all business. You know, if they do well on the court, then they'll stick together.
I feel like you'd be pretty easy to get along with overall.
Yeah, generally. I think I'm a pretty laid back type of guy. But yeah, not, you know, different people from different parts of the world, you know, they have different sort of outlooks on how things go. I can be quite stressy on the court at times. I'm desperate to win all the time. So it was easier to sort of play with my brother towards the end because we were sort of playing as a team. At the start, I was quite stressed because I felt the burden of the stress of the team because I was the older brother. I was trying to teach him how to sort of, you know, do things day to day, and I felt like I was doing a good enough job, but when it came to sort of the crunch, it was difficult. I felt a little bit too much pressure at times. And then, you know, as he matured, he understood how things were going for me. We were open about things. We were probably, it's great playing with your brother because you can be more open and not let things sort of, you know, unravel on the court or off the court. It was quite easy to sort of get over the issues that we were having. And that's the benefit of playing with a brother. Sometimes if you don't play with a brother, you tend to keep things inside and you let things spiral out of control quite quickly. And you probably should split at times, and you tend to just sort of go with it. But yeah, I mean, overall partners, you know, they come and go, and some work that you don't expect, but a lot of the time you'll find someone that you really click with.
Is there any stigma with being a double specialist on tour? Is there any bad connotations to go with it? You know, obviously it's more fun to watch. Recreational players relate more to it. As you said, you played more doubles. I prefer doubles as well. So was there any difference?
It is a funny one because, I mean, a lot of tournaments that you go to, especially in America, I think more of the English-speaking countries, doubles is played on a more local level. You know, it's more of a club sport, and people like to sort of interact with the doubles guys because they, you know, give a bit of feedback. They say, oh, well, you know, what a great shot this was. The way the game is played, it's interactive in the sense that there's so much sort of banter between the players a little bit more. And that's fun. That's great. But there is obviously the fact that singles is where everything's at. That's, you know, the moneymaker for the sport. And that's fine. I sort of know my place in world tennis, and that's fine. You know, there's really, you know, difficult moments in the sport at the moment, obviously, with what's going on, but we have to accept it. It's part of what, you know, what's going on in the world is bigger than tennis at the moment. And unfortunately, sometimes doubles might have to get cut in a certain way, and that's not great. It's not good for our sport, but everything's run as a business as well. You know, even though it's an entertainment, it's also run as a business. So singles obviously will get priority in that sense, but, you know, I'm pretty chilled out about life. I mean, as I am a bit older, it's, you know, having kids, you sort of, you know, see bigger things than just, you know, just tennis.
You have three boys.
Three boys, yeah. Seven, change? 4 and 1. It's a tough one. It's been great, to be fair, obviously having this period off to be home for a considerable length of time. But my life has changed having children because my schedule has to change just because I need to, you know, compromise with my wife to sort of be home a little bit more. And It's a big burden on her to sort of have to deal with them when I'm away a lot, and it's 3-on-1 is difficult. But we signed up for it. This is what's going to happen, and tennis doesn't last forever. Fortunately for her, it's I'm coming to the latter part of my career, so it won't last too much longer. I wouldn't have thought.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the Tennis.com podcast, but special guest Ken Skupski. He's telling us what life on tour is like when you have 3 little boys at home. Keep listening.
There's quite a few guys from the UK here, and I've noticed that all of them seem to be like absolute doubles superstars. What's up with the Brits being so good at doubles? You mentioned a few there. I mean, all these guys here, and even on tour, there's more names that are just dominating. What's the deal?
I don't know, really. I mean, we've obviously got a good sort of philosophy how things work back in the UK with the LTA have, you know, invested quite a lot in doubles with Louis Kaye. He's a good coach that sort of brings us all together, and we all sort of play by the same, you know, playbook. And that's the thing is, we could all play with different players from the UK and sort of fit in quite well together. I could play with Jamie, Neil could play with Johnny O'Mara, you know, Joe Salisbury could play with Bembridge. You know, we can all mix and match, and we could all play well, which we have done in the past. And it's nice to be able to play with, you know, traditional doubles players, guys that generally all serve volley and play the game, but it's changing. There's a lot more people playing from the baseline these days, and the playbook is getting bigger because there's more, you know, sort of players to sort of come up against that all play a different style of play. So overall, we've generally been, you know, we've had a lot of success in doubles, and long may it continue.
But Louis Kaye is a Canadian who moved over to the LTA. You would have probably started working with him in your mid-20s. How does that influence so much? Is it because he has like 5 points he tells you and all of a sudden you're a top 100? Like what's happening? And how often do you even see him and like work together?
Yeah, it's a bit sporadic more now. His role in the LTA, I think, has changed over the years. He still does, you know, most of the big tournaments, but he's more part of the coach ed for the LTA now. But when I first came out of college, I knew all about him. I knew sort of his history. I'd read his book about his sort of philosophy on how doubles is played, and it's, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, by the numbers. And it was interesting to see. He was quite famous for his ropes. He'd study the game in terms of, you know, angles, and it's not until you actually put ropes down on the court that you actually realize sort of areas of the court that you don't need to cover. You think you have to cover everything, but you don't. And that was something that was very sort of mind-blowing when you actually get out there and you do it. And, you know, you do it day in, day out. You work on the sort of the most basic things, you know, serve and return and first volleying. And you can study the game off the court as well. You don't have to be on the court. And he sort of gave us an idea with, you know, video technology these days of what's good, what's bad, and how to do things. And we all bought into it. And as once you buy into something and you buy into a philosophy and you all stick to it, you've got a better chance of doing well. If you just make things up as you go along, it's a lot more difficult.
It's working. What do you hope is next? I mean, you've mentioned a few times here you're getting older. You're 37. That's not exceptionally old, but sure. And you're not sure how much longer you're going to play. Do you have a plan for what you want to do next besides obviously be at home?
I definitely want to stay in the game. I love the sport. I mean, whatever that brings, I don't know if there's a job offer out there, maybe. But no, it's while I'm playing, I'm still doing well. I mean, with COVID, the way things are happening, I mean, I'm going to keep my ranking at where it is for quite a while. So, I will continue to play tennis while I'm making money and enjoying it. And that's, you know, as we go down the line with the way things are going, it's hard to sort of tell when that might change. But there's no obvious signs of where I'm going to go with it yet. But I definitely want to stay in the game. And that's, you know, that's key for me. And I'd love to work with some, you know, up and coming players. And I feel like I could do a good enough job, but I've got to learn my trade. You know, you can't just guarantee that a good player becomes a great coach. So I'll learn my trade and see where things take me.
Perfect. All right. Thank you for your time on that. No, Ken, it's been great.
Thanks for having me.
From the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, this has been the Tennis.com Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay caught up. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, as well as tennis.com/podcasts. You can also see the videos of our episodes
on Tennis Channel's YouTube page and Tennis.com's Facebook page. We're your hosts, Nina Pantic and Irina Falcone. We'd like to thank our team, editor and audio designer and video editor Christina Koseva, producers Alexa March and Sean O'Malley, and executive producers Shelby Coleman, Kyle Einhorn, and Andy Chu.